From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, when good doctors make mistakes, we talk with surgical resident Dr. Atul Gawande, author of the new book, Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. Gawande also writes about medicine and science for The New Yorker. Also, the story of the Afghan women's resistance. We talk with Cheryl Bernard. Her new book, Veiled Courage, is a history of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, and it's a portrait of its founder, who was tortured and killed. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Inhabiting the Ball, the third album by Chicago singer-songwriter Jim Roll. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Colin Powell has left Israel after failing to secure a ceasefire between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Before ending his Mideast trip, Powell said Israeli troops must leave Palestinian cities and that the Palestinians must do more to end the violence. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Secretary Powell had blunt messages for both the Israeli and Palestinian leaders. He said Yasser Arafat must decide that terrorism must end, and he should take that message to the Palestinian people. Powell also urged Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to act, saying Powell stressed the need for an Israeli withdrawal from Palestinian cities as soon as possible.
Only with the end of the incursion and with the engagement in security talks can a ceasefire be achieved in reality as well as rhetoric.
Sharon has said he will pull his tanks and troops out of most Palestinian cities within a few days, but will stay in Ramallah and Bethlehem. Palestinian Information Minister Yasser Abed Rabo called Powell's trip a catastrophe. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
A federal judge in Portland, Oregon, ruled today that the Justice Department doesn't have the authority to overturn that state's law permitting physician-assisted suicide. Oregon is currently the only state in the nation that allows doctors to assist in the suicides of terminally ill patients who have less than 6 months to live. The federal court case began last November when Attorney General John Ashcroft attempted to ban lethal prescriptions, an action that would have effectively blocked physicians from assisting in suicides. In Los Angeles, a former respiratory therapist who once called himself the Angel of Death has been sentenced to life in prison for killing six elderly patients with drug injections. NPR's Mondalit Del Barco reports.
In court, Efrain Saldivar apologized to and asked forgiveness from the families of his victims, six elderly patients at the Glendale Adventist Medical Center. He's admitted to having injected them intravenously with a muscle relaxant to stop their breathing. Last year, he was arrested and charged after authorities exhumed 20 bodies and found drugs in the remains of six people aged 75 to 87 who had been hospitalized in the mid-1990s. Investigators say they may be even more victims. Saldivar pleaded guilty in a bargain with prosecutors that spared him the possibility of a death sentence. Instead, Superior Court Judge Lance Ito sentenced Saldivar to six life prison terms. He also gave him 15 years to life for attempting to murder one woman who appeared in court to describe how she was almost killed intravenously. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 80 points to close at 10,220 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 6 points. It closed at 1,810. The S&P 500 lost 2 points to close at 1,126. This is NPR News. The Los Angeles City Council refused today to consider the police chief's appeal for reappointment to a second 5-year term. Chief Bernard Parks had asked the council to overturn a decision by the Civilian Police Commission, which refused to reappoint him. Parks needed a 2/3 majority vote from the city council in order to keep his job. Parks said he was unfairly opposed by the police commission, L.A. Mayor James Hahn, and the police union. The commission that refused to reappoint Parks said he was not responsive to community policing and other reforms. European scientists say they've discovered a new order of insect. This would be the first major expansion in the insect kingdom for nearly a century. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
The insects look a bit like praying mantises and probably lived millions of years ago. The discovery began with a graduate student studying a weird bug in the collection of London's Natural History Museum. A few weeks later, a collector mailed him a chunk of amber containing the fossil of a similar bug. A third one turned up in a Berlin museum. The three resemble something called a stick bug, but have different anatomical details. And when the researchers cut the insect open, they found its stomach contained bits of other insects, suggesting that, unlike the stick bugs, these were carnivorous. Researchers reporting in the upcoming issue of the journal Science argue that these insects belong to an entirely new branch of the evolutionary tree, an order they call Mantophasmatodea. The last new insect order was added in 1914. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
Afghanistan's exiled king has left Italy to return to his homeland after 29 years. An Italian military plane is carrying Mohammad Zahir Shah and a delegation from Afghanistan's interim government. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, seeking to improve people's lives by supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and child abuse prevention.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Medicine is a strange and in many ways disturbing business, writes my guest, Dr. Atul Gawande. He says there is science in what we do, yes, but also habit, intuition, and sometimes plain old guessing. The gap between what we know and what we aim for persists, and this gap complicates everything we do. Dr. Gawande is a resident who is close to completing his training in general surgery at a Boston hospital. He's also the son of two doctors. He writes about medicine and science for The New Yorker magazine. Now he has a new collection of essays called Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. Several of his essays are about fallibility, how even the best doctors make mistakes. I asked him to describe a mistake he made in the operating room.
This was a patient who'd come in after a car crash, and she was not breathing when she arrived. You immediately try to put a breathing tube down into her throat so that you can pump air into her lungs, and it would not go. There was bleeding coming up from her mouth to the point that her airway then became completely blocked off, and we had to do an emergency tracheostomy. It was a crazy night, with already a person who'd come in to the emergency room stabbed in the neck, and our attending trauma surgeon was down in the operating room with that gentleman. And so it was left to me, and at that point I was a third year of training. I had done a couple of tracheostomies before, but certainly not in an emergency setting. But I knew that it came down to my finding my way in.
You should just very briefly describe what the procedure is.
So what you have to do is cut down into the trachea, right into the neck, and find a way to get a breathing tube that could go into the lungs and pump air back through.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know quite where to cut, I made my best calculation and did it. But it was almost too late. By the time I found what I thought was the airway, she had arrested. Her heart had stopped beating. The attending surgeon had then made it upstairs from the operating room by that time and found her, found us doing chest compressions. He took over, but there was maybe a minute left before we thought her brain could be damaged, and he could not get it. And the only thing that averted total disaster was that the anesthesiologist gave one more try from above, as we would say, trying to put a tube back down through the mouth, and used a child-sized tube. And that actually reached down into her lungs. We were able to bring air, provide oxygen to her, and she came back.
On those occasions when you have made a mistake,
yeah,
have you discussed it with patients? Can you do that?
You have to. But it's terribly hard. The hard part is, I'll give you the example of the woman that whose tracheostomy we did not succeed with. We did tell her that we had tried and we had failed, and that as a result of that, there was a long period in time, a full 24 hours, where we were not sure she would wake up at all because she'd been without oxygen for so long. And we did have to tell the family, look, her airway had shut down. We had tried to get an emergency tracheostomy to open up her airway, but we had failed. It's one of those situations that makes it very hard to, you're very aware of the legal ramifications of what you're saying. But I think we owe it to ourselves to put those legal ramifications aside and speak with candor to patients about what has happened with to them or to families about what's happened to their loved ones.
How does the threat of malpractice suits affect what you're trained to do or to say to patients and their families when something does go wrong?
You know, it's funny. We don't have any formalized training about how to speak to patients and tell them what's going on. In medical school, you do have sessions where you, you'll even be videotaped going through an interview in an office with a patient who comes in with a belly pain or something like that. But this process is instead this process of coping with complications or how things go wrong is something that you absorb simply as an apprentice, watching other people, seeing how they do it. I think that it's really hard trying to grasp that if your physician is infallible and things go wrong, how can they also be doing things successfully? And you have, on the one hand, the notion that 97, 98% of the time, things do go uncommonly well, and somehow these ordinary people are able to do extraordinary things. But it's the moments of failure, when which everybody struggles with and remembers, and I think we either have the choice of trying to paper over those moments or face up to them and try to explain them and then begin to grapple with how we can reduce the likelihood that the errors will happen, and then also acknowledge the patients when the errors do happen.
My guest is Dr. Atul Gawande. He's a resident in surgery at a Boston hospital. He also writes about medicine and science for the New Yorker magazine. He has a new book called Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. How did you start writing? Did you know that you'd want to practice medicine and write about medicine too?
Well, I came to it long after I'd decided I was going to become a doctor, but it was still early in my training. A friend of mine who'd started Slate Magazine, which is an internet magazine, in its early days, came to me and asked if I would do a favor of him of writing a piece about medicine, because in those days it was early in the beginning of the internet and no one was reading the magazine, and as a result no one was writing for it. And it became a monthly column for me, and a way I could really begin to use writing as a way of thinking about the dilemmas that came up in my day-to-day practice as a doctor. I got lucky. It turned out one of the few readers was an editor at The New Yorker, and I learned through the grapevine that he was actually liking what I was writing about. And I had a longer piece I wanted to write, but it was too long for the internet. And so I wrote him a letter, and he let me write for, and he said, go ahead. And it became an opportunity then to write regularly for The New Yorker. And I've had the chance to think through problems like mistakes and the areas of medicine, which are still a mystery to us, where we don't know everything about what's going on, about unusual operations, and also about this sort of fundamental difficulty for both doctors and patients, which is grappling with uncertainty in medicine.
In your new book, Complications, you have a chapter about pain, and you write, every pain has a story. How true.
Yes.
And you write particularly about a certain type of mysterious pain that doesn't seem to be tied to anything that a doctor can see, either that the doctor can see on the body or that the doctor can see through imaging of the body, through MRIs or X-rays. Give us an example of that type of mysterious pain that the doctor can't explain.
Well, the most common kind is simple back pain. Chronic back pain afflicts millions of people in the United States alone, And yet when you do x-rays and MRIs to find what might be wrong with their spine or their spinal, or the discs around their spine, you often don't find anything structurally wrong. We, in medicine, have a hard time dealing with these patients because what we'll often do is dismiss this as a pain that's all just in the head. And for patients, it's extremely hard to deal with because what they feel is exactly there in their back, and yet they have a doctor telling them, oh, I don't see anything. There's more and more evidence in science and studies that you can have pains, however, that emanate from the brain are completely real. It's as if there's a program for chronic pain that's unreeling in the brain, and that it can start with an injury to the back. And the hard part, I think, for both doctors and patients is grappling with what is not a clearly physical, but not clearly not physical kind of pain. We end up doing operations on people's backs that are sometimes unwarranted. We end up having patients who feel dismissed because they might be asked to go see a psychiatrist to help sort through the sources of a pain. And in that chapter, what I'm trying to do is explain to people how it is that in this area where we know we're actually remarkably little, we can both make both patients and doctors make judgments that lead us in wrong directions.
My guest is Dr. Atul Gawande. His new book is called Complications. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Atul Gawande. His new book is called Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. Well, it sounds from your article that one of the theories now is that the pain system itself can go haywire, and it's not necessarily attached to an injury or to a structural problem. It could just be the pain system itself getting out of whack.
That's right. The pain is a kind of program in the brain, and it's almost, you can imagine it as a kind of symphony. There is the feeling of the pain, and there's the memory of the pain itself, and there's all the emotions that go along with it. And what can set the symphony playing is certainly, you know, a hammer to the back. But if you've had a significant injury to your back or anywhere else in your body, it can become possible that the pain program starts to get unleashed with even a normal sensation, just a touch to the back, or sometimes even a depression or social circumstances. That I tell the story of this architect who has had a terrible back pain for 8, 9, 10 years that has made it impossible for him to do his work. He is a guy who built medical schools and now is barely able to make it out of his house. And he's gone for x-rays and MRIs of every kind. And the doctors keep telling him, well, they don't find anything. What seems to be going on for somebody like him, where just sitting in a chair and trying to get up can bring on a pain as if someone has put a knife into his back, is that he is a victim of a problem where his pain system has started to go haywire, go out of control. And we're only beginning to provide answers for medications that actually could focus not on the back, but instead on this haywire pain system. And also find other kinds of treatments that might work as well that may not even be medical or using drugs.
Can you give us an example of one of the new medical ways of treating this kind of pain when what you're dealing with is the pain system itself as opposed to a more physical problem that's manifesting itself in pain?
Well, one of the medications that has turned out to people's surprise to have made a difference is anti-seizure medications. Anti-seizure medications are medications that kind of reduce the threshold at which the brain cells would fire in certain parts of the brain. And an anti-seizure medication can turn out to help for people with these kind of chronic pains that just won't go away and can become so devastating. And it's because we started to shift the focus from trying to figure out what we might do to the muscles in the back there or to the bone or the discs in the back, and to focus then on the pain system itself that's working in the brain.
How does the anti-seizure medication affect the pain system?
Well, what it seems to do, and this is now into a kind of speculation that researchers have as a hypothesis for how it's working, but that it is controlling it is stabilizing what may be cells that fire almost too readily. It raises the threshold for when fibers in the pain system would be unleashed and fire. And by raising that threshold, make it easier for the pain system, make it less likely that the pain system would go off with that just the light touch to the back or the day when you find that things just aren't going right and that only compounds the pain that's going on in your back.
You mentioned that toxins are sometimes used to help stop the pain. What kind of toxins, and what's the principle behind using them?
Well, there are these unusual studies using frogs from South America that have poisonous toxins that can kill people. And what researchers have tried to do is tame those toxins by altering them ever so slightly until they reach the point that they're not toxic any longer, but still working on the same brain cells that they targeted in the first place. So instead of killing those cells, they modulate them so that the pain then doesn't occur. One of those drugs has been found to be in early animal trials to be 30, 40, 50 times more powerful than morphine, with the hope that it would be a kind of morphine without those same side effects that morphine can have. These are the early directions that research is going in that's opened up by beginning to think about chronic pain as a problem that is not necessarily just simply your the tissues of your shoulder or your back, but instead a process that is centrally in the brain.
So there's a lot of pretty interesting work going on in this area. When you have pain, the doctor always asks you to rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. And yeah. It always seems to me, well, that's such a subjective scale. And is it according to how much you think you could possibly endure? Or are you supposed to be comparing your pain to the average pain? Like, if the average person has pain, how severe is your pain? And how can you know what someone else's pain is like and how your pain might compare to their pain? Is there any way that's a little less subjective of reporting how much pain you're in to a doctor?
There's not, in the sense that, you know, pain is only what you experience. And that's what makes it so hard for you as a patient to convey to doctors. And that's what makes it hard for doctors sometimes to be as aware and sympathetic as we sometimes ought to be. I think what's really important about that question that we ask, you know, rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10, is number one, that we ask it. It's become the kind of fifth vital sign besides your temperature and your pulse and your blood pressure and your breathing. It's become an important habit for us to ask how much pain you have. And then by asking people to rate it, it tells us how important it is for them, because the sensitivities and thresholds that different people have for pain vary enormously and change over time. There's an interesting and fascinating study of athletes. And I talk, for example, in the book about a study of ballerinas in which it was found that these ballerinas had extraordinarily high thresholds for pain. They tolerated as a daily matter pain that is beyond levels of some of even football players. And it's partly because of their training. It's partly because of the culture of ballerinas to accept the pain. But it also explains why they end up with frequent chronic injuries, because they've inured themselves to pain to the point that their own joints can break down before they recognize what's going on.
Does it frighten you ever to watch your patients go through severe pain and to know the kinds of things that humans sometimes have to endure?
It does. There's a doubleness to doctoring, which is that you are someone who is spending years and years training yourself to be dispassionate and analytical about what you do. You have to be systematic. You have to know the literature. You have to know the science. You have to have experience of dealing in situations so that you make good decisions. At the same time, we are all humans ourselves, subject to the same frailties that our patients have. And being able to grasp those that distinction, not let go too much of one side or the other, is the hard thing to do. I think at times I'm probably too cold, and then at other times you can find yourself absorbed so directly in the experience of what is happening that you have to step back for a minute and remember that this patient needs you to do something and not just feel something.
Well, Dr. Atul Gawande, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, and I want to thank you.
Dr. Atul Gawande is the author of Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. He also writes about medicine and science for The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Harcourt, publisher of The Middle of Everywhere, The World's Refugees Come to Our Town, Stories from the Frontline of Refugee Life in America by Mary Pfeiffer. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a history of the underground women's resistance in Afghanistan. We talk with Cheryl Bernard, author of Veiled Courage. And Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Chicago singer-songwriter Jim Roll. It features collaborations with novelists Rick Moody and Dennis Johnson. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Even before the Taliban took away all of women's rights, an Afghan women's resistance group fought against the subordination of women. My guest, Cheryl Bernard, has written a history of the group RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. The book is called Veiled Courage. Bernard first learned about the group during a 1982 trip to the country when she was helping assess the efficiency with which aid was being delivered to Afghan refugees by the international community. Bernard is now a consultant to the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. She's married to Zalmay Khalilzad, the Bush administration's special envoy for Afghanistan. He was born and raised in Afghanistan. I asked Bernard to describe RAWA.
It started out as an intellectual student movement similar to what happened in the 1970s on Western campuses, a kind of an elite phenomenon of women who got together to discuss the topics of the day and felt rebellious about some of the things in the society around them. And then Afghanistan started falling apart with the overthrow of the monarchy, the coup, the counter-coup, the Soviet occupation. And RAWA had the choice to either dissolve itself and wait for better days or to change itself into something else politically. And what happened was they underwent several transformations. They went into the opposition to the pro-Soviet government in Afghanistan, which necessitated their beginning clandestine work because the degree of repression and the number of arrests, those were very high, and the work began to become dangerous. So they started to operate underground a little bit. And then the diaspora began, and large numbers of Afghans had to flee the country because the situation became so difficult. And most RAWA members also ended up in Pakistan or in Iran in refugee camps. And again, the organization could have dissolved, especially after its founding leader, Mina, was murdered. But instead, they decided to use the resources that they had, which was mainly education, to work in the refugee camps. And they started to set up schools and literacy programs and health programs. And at that point, the organization underwent its most interesting phase because it moved from being a upper middle class movement of intellectuals to becoming a movement that really represented the entire population and had started to have a large number of just ordinary, rural, non-literate members who joined through attending literacy classes in the camps until it became an extremely broad-based movement. And then they started embarking on the work that they became known for in the United States, too, through a CNN, BBC documentary that many, many people saw,
Behind the Veil. Mm-hmm.
Yes. They started doing secret documentation of Taliban excesses, such as the public executions in the soccer stadium, by filming them from behind their veils. And this was work that was extremely dangerous, because if they had been caught, they definitely would have been killed.
RAWA was founded by a woman named Mina. What led her to create it? What was happening in her life that led her to create a women's group?
She was a very earnest girl, even in high school already. It was a time of great political turmoil in Afghanistan, and she found that very fascinating. She was very upset by the huge social problems and the social disparities that she saw around her. She had she was one of those teenagers with a strong social conscience. And when she became active at the university, there were a lot of political groups around, but she saw that they were missing two components. Women were not involved in them. And they weren't what she thought they should be in terms of being more normally middle of the road kind of democratic. They were more extremely left or extremely right. And she wanted a broad-based, very democratic group that allowed women to become very active in it. So she formed the first women's organization in Afghanistan.
Now, I think she went to the same university as Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, and they were there at about the same time. What is his importance in this story?
Gulbuddin Hekmatyar is one of the fundamentalist leaders, one of the mujahideen who fought against the Soviets in the 1980s. He, at the time that Mina was a student, he was a student as well. He was already a pronounced fundamentalist. He had a group around him who engaged in such pursuits as throwing acid at women students who were not dressed what in his view was the correct Islamic style of dress. He would have preferred women not to be allowed at the universities at all. I actually met him in Peshawar in the 1980s and interviewed him. It was a very bizarre experience. He lived in a kind of fortress setting where it was rumored that he had his own personal prison where he kept his opponents, and he was an extremely feared figure. He was associated with many assassinations and killings, and he is rumored to have killed Mina's husband, who was murdered in Pakistan along with many, many other more liberal activists during that time.
What was Mina's marriage like? Did she have an arranged marriage? Did she marry for love?
Mina is very romantic. Yes, she married for love. She met her husband at the university. And it was, from the beginning, both a personal and an intellectual partnership. We have a number of her writings on this subject. And she describes him in a way that I think one can imagine him very well. There are a number of men like that. He supported the women's movement. He supported her work. But he also could never resist a humorous approach to this. So he liked making his jokes about it as well. She had a sort of a fundamental discussion that she relates in her memoirs with him when she decided to form her own women's organization. And he asked what the relationship of that organization to his own group would be. He had a more pronounced leftist organization that he was the head of. And she told him that they would need to learn how to separate their personal relationship from their political relationship, because she wanted her group to be different from his in terms of its political values, and also to operate completely independently. It was one of the enduring problems of her political life, and also of Rawa, that Afghans found that very, very difficult to believe. And they persisted in thinking that her organization just had to be kind of a shadow of his, and that he was probably secretly in charge of the whole thing. And she was often trying to refute that, but it was hard to convince people of it.
Now, you mentioned that she had written about her views on marriage. Do you think that Mina was influenced by the Western feminist movement?
She was definitely influenced by all of the thoughts that carried through during the 1970s and 80s in the West, too, the thoughts of what women's role in society should be. She also realized something that I think contributed to her importance. She realized that since her life was very unconventional by Afghan standards, and her marriage was unconventional, people were going to be watching her very closely. And she, rather than fight against that, she accepted it. And she accepted the fact that she was going to become a role model for many Afghan women. And so at various points in her life, for example, when she was pregnant, she made a point of confronting the questions that were in people's minds very openly and saying, you know, just because a woman is pregnant doesn't mean that she can't continue with her work. This was something very radical, a very radical thought for Afghan society. Just because a woman is married doesn't mean she can't have her own opinions and her own organization, and her husband cannot support that. Her husband, was very helpful in that regard, and very often also made public statements on that, saying that he realized the enormous importance of her work and the enormous importance of getting women more engaged politically. So they made their marriage also a political act, in the sense of demonstrating what an alternative kind of a relationship between a man and a woman could be.
My guest is Cheryl Bernard, author of the new book Veiled Courage, Inside the Afghan Women's Resistance. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Cheryl Bernard, is the author of Veiled Courage, a history of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. It's also a profile of RAWA's founder, Mina. Mina, the founder of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, was murdered. What do you know about the circumstances of her murder?
Mina was murdered during the mid-1980s. The Soviets were occupying Afghanistan. The United States was backing an alliance of mujahideen, of mostly fundamentalist resistance groups that were trying to eject the Soviets and were fighting against them. There were also a number of other groups, political groups, based in Pakistan who were also fighting against the Soviets, more liberal democratic groups. The U.S. did not support those groups because they thought that it would be better to support the more fanatical groups who were likely to throw themselves into the struggle against the Soviets with more fervor and abandon. And therefore, there was a power struggle among the various resistance groups, and the liberal democratic ones were systematically destroyed and their leaders killed by the fundamentalist ones. And one of those leaders was Mina.
The American government has become very sympathetic to the women's resistance in Afghanistan and to women's rights in Afghanistan. At the time that Mina was murdered, do you think that the American government then had much knowledge of her work and the women's resistance?
Mina
or
was
much interest?
The decision had been made on a policy level that the war in Afghanistan could not be won, but what was won was merely going to try to increase the cost. And that fateful and erroneous decision led to liberal democratic groups getting no support from the United States. And in retrospect, we can see how extremely short-sighted and dangerous that decision was, because what happened was that education became run by fundamentalists. The next generation of Afghans was raised in madrasas, and essentially the United States helped produce the Taliban and helped produce the events that led to September 11th by encouraging one sector in that society at the expense of another. Mina often said that if she had only a fraction of the money that each of the radical fundamentalist resistance groups was getting from the United States, she could educate all the children in the refugee camps in liberal democratic values, but she didn't get that support. She had to run her schools by running little handicraft centers and little factories and workshops by refugee women. Hopefully now that the U.S. has discovered the women as a force for democracy and for civil values in the Islamic world, this will change, and they will have that more on their radar screen and will continue to support such groups.
What is RAWA doing now in Afghanistan?
RAWA has come to the judgment that they're worried about the interim government, and they are concerned about the high degree of participation of the Northern Alliance. And so they've decided to wait and see and could continue their activities in the border area and in the refugee camps until they feel that the security situation is better and the political situation is more reliable.
And they're worried about the former members of the Northern Alliance because the Northern Alliance was responsible for a lot of rapes when they were ruling Afghanistan.
Yes, that's correct. They have had extremely bad experiences with the Northern Alliance, and they don't trust them, and they don't think that people who have been involved in that sort of thing belong in a government. They believe that they belong on trial for war crimes, and in fact, along with the Basque government, they've initiated a proceeding that they want to try for that. They want to try to put some of these people on trial for war crimes.
Cheryl Bernard is my guest. Her new book is called Veiled Courage: Inside the Afghan Women's Resistance. We've seen several women suicide bombers in the Middle East in the past few weeks. What does it say to you that women are taking on this role that only men have done before, at least among the Palestinians? I don't know that suicide bombers are the area where we wanted equality, but still that this must say something.
Well, for me personally, as a Western feminist, even Mina's position was very thought-provoking. She consciously, when the situation in Afghanistan started falling apart and she had to decide what to do with her organization, she made a conscious decision that women should make up their minds to take exactly the same political risks that men do, because it was her belief that the reason women haven't gotten any further in politics and aren't really taken seriously, that they continue to be cautious, that when it's you're out in the front risking your life, it's the men. And as long as only men do that, only men will get the power afterwards. And she decided for her organization that they were not going to do that, that they were going to take exactly the same risks that men do, and they were also going to put their lives on the line for what they believed in. However, she also determined that they wanted to be nonviolent. That's one of the founding principles of RAWA, is nonviolence and not using arms or any kind of violent interventions. They have been widely criticized for that, and many people have felt that to take that level of risk against the Taliban and not arm yourself and not use weapons is very unwise. So I suppose the suicide bombers, the female suicide bombers, are taking the logic a step further and are saying that if you want full equal political rights, then you have to accept the full level of engagement and the full tactics and political tactics that men do. I have a problem with it, but I can see the logic.
Cheryl Bernard, I'm wondering if studying the women's resistance in Afghanistan has led you to any new thoughts about feminism in the United States.
Yes, I think that we can certainly learn a lot from RAWA, and one of the things we can learn from is their willingness to use the support of men. This is something that the women's movement in the West usually disdains, and I think that's a mistake, because if we really believe that the new society we're aiming for is better for everyone, then I don't see why men shouldn't participate in bringing it about. And for RAWA, this has been a completely natural thing to do, and for us here, it seems difficult, and I think we should study their approach. Another thing that we can learn from them is their admiration of other women. This is often very difficult for Western feminists. There's a lot of, as anyone who's been in a woman's group will know, there's unfortunately a high degree of mutual criticism and of not wanting anyone to emerge as a leader, sort of a false egalitarianism. And the way RAWA admires Mina, for instance, and really devotes themselves to her principles and admires the risk she took, and that, I think, is very productive and useful, too.
Cheryl Bernard is the author of Veiled Courage, Inside the Afghan Women's Resistance. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by singer-songwriter Jim Roll that features his collaborations with novelists Rick Moody and Dennis Johnson. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Jim Roll is a singer-songwriter from Chicago whose new third album, called Inhabiting the Ball, features collaborations with a couple of well-known novelists, Rick Moody, author of The Ice Storm, and Dennis Johnson, best known for his short story sequence, Jesus' Son. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
That's Jim Roll on his own. He wrote the lyrics and the music to Bonnie and Clyde, a nice chunk of wordy rock and roll that seems to exist primarily to compare the musician's object of desire to Faye Dunaway circa 1967. Now let's hear what happens when Roll supplies the melody for a lyric by novelist Rick Moody.
Trucks pass bearing the widest loads. Sad blonde by a black car buys amber blends and waits for a friend. The hay bales toil like the wheels of Brie. They give the land away for free. Killjoy, killjoy. Don't be a killjoy.
Rick Moody, a self-conscious artist, and I don't necessarily mean that as a criticism, is shrewd enough to know that the last thing a novelist should do in a piece of music is fill it with a lot of novelistic, that is to say, narrative detail. So instead, he offers a series of simple images. A farm stand whose roof is warped from the rain. Crows swooping past. The images are stark, unadorned, like those from a William Carlos Williams poem. It's nice, nothing more, nothing less. Now let's hear what happens when Dennis Johnson, a generally more fervid writer than Moody, and a poet as well, hands Jim Roll a lyric.
When I hung my handsome Daniel, he looked so high surprised. Gold fell from his pockets, and a crow fell from the skies. When they hung my handsome Daniel, he looked so high surprised.
Well, that's different from everything Jim Roll's done before. Johnson's fondness for invoking death with abrupt images, in this case, a hanging, and his use of mysterious possessives. Why does the narrator call him my handsome Daniel? Is he talking about a son, a lover? It adds to the atmosphere of the song. Here's where Rick Moody picks an easy target, condescending to the sort of woman who would read something as flimsy as an in-flight magazine. Jim Roll's Chuck Berry guitar riff and nicely sour harmony vocal disguises the smugness, which pops up again later when Moody lets you know he knows who George Plimpton is. I prefer the directness of Dennis Johnson's words in Heartache Song.
All your promises, the things you said, using grand words like eternity and love. You told me together we would see the end of time. You told me together we would watch that last star fall. The horrible truth is that you meant it. The awful truth is you meant every word. My heart breaks for anybody out there saying these words tonight. My heart breaks for anybody listening.
I have no idea how Jim Roll came to collaborate with Moody or Johnson, but it was a good commercial idea since it guarantees that someone like me will give the songs a closer scrutiny. For the record, as it were, I recommend Dennis Johnson's stuff with enthusiasm. Check out his poetry collection called The Throne of the Third Heaven of the Nation's Millennium General Assembly. And give this guy Jim Roll a spin.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Inhabiting the Ball from Jim Roll. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Therapy is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Strings were frayed on your guitar. The nylon strings, the busted case. The frets had pried themselves away. The capo too was stuck in place. D's and A's and G's. It all been rounded off. The pitch pipe made a buzzing sound. We gave away our blue guitar. We gave away your blue guitar.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Yoga Gems, a treasury of practical and spiritual wisdom from ancient and modern masters, edited by George Feuerstein, Ph.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with actor, writer, and comic Dennis Leary. The final episode of his sitcom, The Job, will be shown next week. He's not sure if the series will be renewed. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.